You may proceed.
May it please the Court, Alejandro Fernandez for Mr. Richard Dates. Your Honors, Richard Dates was awoken before 7 in the morning in his home to the repeated knocks of two officers at his door. When he came to the door, he testified he was still in his underwear. He was groggy from only having about 3 hours of sleep from the night before. When he spoke to the officers, he was speaking to them through a door that was only partly ajar. And the officers superficially acknowledged that he was still sleeping when they arrived. They apologized for waking him up. Soon after they began speaking, Mr. Dates said, in very clear terms, he did not want to talk to them. He repeated that phrase, "I do not want to talk to you right now. I do not want to talk to you. There's nothing I want to say to you," at least three times before the officers invited him to speak outside of his home.
Are you contending he was seized at that point?
Your Honor, he was seized at the point of his final attempt to discontinue the conversation. And that would be the third time he said, "I do not want to speak anymore."
On the doorstep?
Still at the threshold of his door, yes, Your Honor.
So we can analytically, from your perspective, we can stop there.
Your Honor, I wouldn't invite you to stop there because there's so much more. So I would say that there is a reasonable belief that at that point, still at his threshold of his door, where he had said already three times, "I do not want to speak," that he did not feel, as a reasonable person would not feel, free to discontinue that encounter, to terminate that encounter. But there is much more. Afterwards,
if I could interrupt, what part of the statements are you seeking to suppress?
Everything that occurred inside the car and thereafter.
What was incriminating?
The most incriminating statement, and the statement that the district judge called a crucial admission, was that he used the email address walrus.blackhawk, and both as a Skype handle as well as an email address. What the district court judge found was that they knocked on his door in order to, and I'm quoting the finding of the district court judge, intending to confirm that defendant was the actual user of the walrus.blackhawk screen name. That was the crux of the case. That was the linchpin.
If that's the crux of the case, and I think I see your point there, if we disagree with you that there was a seizure prior to that time, you lose, right? Because if there was no seizure, that statement provided reasonable suspicion for any seizure that would come past that point.
Well, Your Honor,
do you have an argument to be made if we disagree at the point the seizure occurred?
I think Your Honor is right if that statement is made early on in the interaction. That statement, however, was made after they were already inside the vehicle, the car.
Right. I understand that. But I'm saying, suppose we disagree with you about that and think that he got into the car voluntarily, which there certainly would be some evidence of that since the officers said he could meet them at McDonald's and he chose to get in the car and go. So we might disagree with you. And if we do, I guess I'm asking if we think a seizure might have occurred after that statement, but in the car, do you have any argument to be made about the scope of the stop after that point or the statements that were asked after that point where they would have reasonable suspicion?
Your Honor, if we disagree about that point, I think then the analysis would switch more firmly to the Fifth Amendment question about whether or not they had to advise him that he had the right to remain silent in all the Miranda warnings. If Your Honor finds that a seizure was never, that Mr. Dates was never subject to a seizure for Fourth Amendment purposes because it was voluntary, as Your Honor said, then I don't think that you would find that any subsequent statement obviously was the fruit of an unlawful seizure. But I would still argue that within a car, a moving car, it was a police dominant, all the factors that find a custodial interrogation were present. Police-dominated setting, a setting in which there was persistent and intrusive questioning, and that Mr. Dates was never told that he can leave and never told that he can discontinue that conversation. But I would like to ask to respond to Your Honor's sort of characterization of the car being a a setting in which Mr. Dates voluntarily went into. The exact phrase of the officers was, you can come with us or we can follow you in our car. Those are two options, and neither of which sound to a normal citizen a unencumbered journey. One is one which the officers are tailing your car. Any driver, I think, would recognize that known officers following your every movement to a set location is not freedom or is not free to leave in a traditional sense. And the other, obviously, was within their car, clearly a police-dominated setting, clearly a situation in which he was not free to leave. And I would call you...
Did the car ever make it to the McDonald's?
My understanding is that it did make it to the McDonald's, but by then, at around 45 minutes into the interaction, according to the recording, Mr. Dates then unequivocally invoked his right to counsel, and that's when the...
Right. So part of the conversation took place. They were parked in the parking lot of the McDonald's, but still in the car.
I believe that's right, Your Honor. I would say
they were never outside the car.
I don't think so. And the crucial admissions were made, it's pretty clear from the recording, while the car was moving. On a number of occasions, Mr. Dates said that this was a school zone, they should slow down, and made other references to directions. The officers were relying on Mr. Dates for the directions to the McDonald's, indicating that they were still moving, that this was a car that had not been parked at that point.
Isn't that a pretty good sign that he didn't, that he wasn't in custody, that he could advise the officers to, he was comfortable enough to say, hey, this is school zone, you ought to slow down, officer?
I don't think that his desire to remain safe is an indication that he was free to leave. I think he was trying to grasp at whatever, perhaps whatever control he could have in the setting, but he acknowledged in a number of ways that his movements were curtailed by the officers. I would say the most significant goes back all the way to when he was still inside the apartment. He responded to the officers when he was in his underwear. So clearly before he can leave, he had to get dressed. But the officer,
doesn't that indicate he felt comfortable in terminating the encounter at that point?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because the officers indicated that they were going to remain near the door. There is a single point of egress, and the officers continued chatting outside the door, making their presence known, and also telling Mr. Dates that they weren't going anywhere, the only reason that they were going to leave was with Mr. Dates to the designated location.
Well, didn't Mr. Dates make that suggestion that they go somewhere else?
Your Honor, we can
meet someplace else.
Your Honor, those specific words were said, but I would argue, Your Honor, in context that it had a very different meaning. When he said originally, well, I don't think I really want to talk to you right now, the agent seized on that statement and said, when would you like to talk to us? He responds, I don't know. In any normal interaction, if someone's saying, when do you want to talk to me? And I say, I don't know. Anything after that is harassment. Anything after that is a clear indication that you are pushing the interaction beyond where you'd want it to go. If it was an on-the-street encounter between, let's say, someone collecting money for a charity and a citizen, we would be pretty clear that that was a harassing interaction. I say, I don't want to give you money now. And you say, well, when do you want to give me money? And I said, I don't know. And that person continues arguing, continues the conversation, pushes me forward. That is something that any normal and understanding of a conversation, any traditional sense of an interaction among two free people would be strained.
Well, counsel, can I just pick up there? So I think what you're saying is the officer continues to persist, correct? I mean, that's your problem with this interaction.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
So but how do you draw the line between persistence in a seizure? Aren't officers persistent? How do we tell when it turns into a seizure?
Your Honor, I don't know if there's a bright line rule, but I would say that certainly one time a citizen saying that they don't want to speak is probably not enough. Two times, similarly, probably not enough. Three times, it starts to look like there's a presumption of a seizure. Three times where he's saying, I don't know, in response to, well, when do you want to talk? And he says, I don't know. And then to get back to Judge Timkovich's question also, isn't he the one who suggested somewhere else? What he said was, I don't want to talk to you here. And it was then the officer who said, on page 8, he said, we can meet someplace else. And it was the officer who said, well, where do you want to meet? And again, he said, I don't know.
So is that the fourth time of persistence?
I would say the fourth or fifth by that point,
okay.
Because prior he said, I don't know, to time. The second time he said, I don't know, was to place. So there's at least five times at which he tried to discontinue the conversation by either saying explicitly, I don't want to talk to you right now, or in response to questions to specify time or place, he said, I don't know. Those are traditionally statements that we construe as indications that an encounter is going beyond where we want to go and that we would like to discontinue the conversation. With respect to the Fifth Amendment inquiry, there's even more in play. Mr. Dates at that point is in the back of a moving car. All the other preceding conversations have already taken place. There's a clear indication that he cannot go. And I'll call upon your honors to look at the case Jones, which is cited in the briefs, but also written by your honor Timkovich in 2008, where it was important that the officer in Jones told to the defendant, you're free to leave. He pointed at the locks at the door and said, they're open. You're not under arrest. And ultimately, this court decided in Jones that there was a tension between the officer saying that you can be arrested, but we're not arresting you now, and the explicit statement that you're free to leave and that the doors are open. And it was that explicit statement from the officers that you're free to leave that weighed so heavily in favor of not finding a custodial setting. In this case, no such statement was made, and to the contrary, there was a good amount of deception used, where Mr. Dates was told that he was actually not the subject of an investigation, but instead perhaps a victim of another investigation or of another defendant. There is all sorts of indications yes.
Can you stop there? So what role does the, I guess you term it, deception play?
Well, the deception in the Fourth Amendment context has been found to be one factor in which a seizure could be found, because the case in Harrison relied also in the briefs showed that guileful deception could be just as powerful as forcible shows of police authority. So in that case, I would say that whatever amount of consent is apparent would be undermined by the officer's lies. Your Honors, I would ask to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
You may. Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors.
May it please the Court. My name is Marissa Ong, and I'm an Assistant United States Attorney in Las Cruces, New Mexico. Counsel, this Court should find that the District Court did not err in concluding that the encounter with the Dates and law enforcement on August 23, 2012 was consensual. Additionally, the Court did not err in finding that there was no custody in this case, and so Miranda warnings were not required. Now, I want to go back through some of the points that Mr. Fernandez brought up during his argument and that the Court had questions about. Officers get to Dates' house around 7 a.m., and he answers the door, and he comes out. They identify themselves, and he comes outside and says, okay, yeah, I'll talk to you. And there is a point where he says, I don't think I want to talk to you right now. And the officer simply follows up with, okay, when would you like to talk? And he does kind of hedge a little bit, and the officer tries to tell him.
Well, he hedges a lot. He hedges a lot. He doesn't want to talk to them. It's pretty clear. They persist. But I guess my question to you is, somewhat like Judge Ide is asking, at what point does this persistence become sort of the overwhelming factor? I mean, Spence tells us the seventh factor is whether or not the officers advised him that he was free to leave. Clearly, they didn't do that here, and had they done so, it's pretty clear what would have happened. He didn't want to talk to them. He would have loved to hear that. So does that factor become even more important when the defendant is exhibiting over and over again hesitance and unwillingness to speak?
Well, Judge Moritz, I don't think he's exhibiting hesitance to talk to them at all. What he says is, I don't want to talk to you right now, and I don't want to talk to you here. And what we know from the Little case, in Little, which was an en banc decision out of this court, there the court specifically found that the district court below had erred in relying so heavily on the fact that the agents in that conversation had not advised the person they were speaking to that they didn't have to talk to them. So I think Little makes clear that what this court looks at, it's a totality of the circumstances. There is a factor test in Spence that's employed. But at the end of the day, no one factor is determinative. And I actually don't think that if the officers had told them, you don't have to talk to us right now, Dates wouldn't have spoken to them. If you actually listen to the audio recording of what happened, the officer's tone is completely polite, and that's a specific finding that the district court made. And Dates actually goes back in. He says, okay, I don't want to talk to you here. Let's go somewhere else. Let's go to McDonald's. He goes back into his apartment, and he's in his apartment for 6.5 minutes. That gave him ample time to go back into his own private space and say, you know what, these officers are here. I don't actually really want to talk to them. I'm going to come back out and tell them that. But what happens is he goes into his apartment. He's in there for 6.5 minutes. Then he comes back outside, and the officers say, okay, you want to go to McDonald's? And he says, yeah. They say, would you like to come with us, or would you like to follow us? He says, you know what, I'll go with you. And during Dates' testimony, he actually testified that he thought it made the most sense to go with the officers. He never said anything in his testimony about feeling compelled to go with the officers, that he didn't have a choice as to whether or not he could drive his own vehicle. He said he thought it made the most sense. And I think if you look at this from the context of a reasonable person, when you're given the option, would you like to come with us or take your own car, that would not lead a reasonable person to conclude that they had to ride with the officers. That was completely his choice that he made. And Judge Moritz, I know that you had some questions for the appellant about, okay, well, once they actually get into the car, there's a good 12.5 minutes where they're riding in the car where they're just going back and forth. Dates does not say anything about, I don't want to answer this question. And it's within the first 3 minutes that he actually admits that he uses the Walrus Blackhawk Hotmail.
And that leads me to another question I had. The district court here said that after the defendant unequivocally asked for an attorney, and they said, okay, we're going to turn around, we're going to take you back home. And they do that. They turn around. She said there was no more questioning, but I don't think that's correct, is there? They continued to question him.
So what you hear is Agent Garcia follows up with Dates and says, you know, you're pretty adamant that you're not involved in any of this. When we get back to your house, can I search your computer? And to that, Dates actually says no. So I think that that fact also supports the conclusion that this is a consensual encounter, that he's not in custody because he has no problem.
Well, I'm saying I think it's a pretty key point where, and the district court made this finding, that he unequivocally requested an attorney and the officer said fine, and he understood that, you know, they stop questioning for a bit and they say, we're turning around, we're taking you home. And then they start questioning him again. And the district court seemed to miss that. And I wonder, I guess, if at that point we decide that at that point it was a seizure, what's your argument?
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe that it was a seizure. So,
well, I'm saying if we were to say it was.
Sure. I mean, after that point, I don't think that the appellant has actually briefed or challenged any of the interactions that occurred after the first encounter. And so my position would be that those arguments have been forfeited and that this court should respect the findings of the district court that any encounter that happened after that, the second encounter with law enforcement, was consensual, and that
even if the district court erred in saying there was no further communication or questioning when there was?
Well, Your Honor, I think that what the district court was saying is that the agents were not continuing to ask incriminating questions, and what the district court specifically made note of in its findings was that Date's Sixth Amendment right to counsel had not attached because no criminal proceedings had been brought against him. And so I think what the district court was saying, clearly there's case law that says, hey, once you lawyer up, you have to cease questioning, but that's in the context of...
I understand that, but she made the finding that there was no seizure at any point as well, and so I'm asking more about the seizure right now. The Fourth Amendment issue.
Sure, Your Honor. So I think after they get to McDonald's, there's a break, right? So there's about a 9-minute break where the agents go in and use the restroom. They ask Dates, hey, would you like to use the restroom? And then on their way back, there is a little bit of chatter, but after that, you know, Dates says, hey, I asked for a lawyer. I don't want to talk to you anymore. And then the only follow-up conversation that they have is the agent giving Dates his card, and Dates is explaining to him, I want to talk to a lawyer, and if the lawyer advises me that, you know, I should cooperate with you, I'll get back in touch with you. And while this is happening, Dates is still giving directions as to where to go. And so I think all of that signifies that this continues to be a consensual encounter, that he's not in custody, and I don't know if I've already made this point. I know I made it in my brief, but the fact that Dates is giving the officers directions, at one point he even tells the driver to slow down. This happens both on the way to McDonald's and on the way back. And as I stated, I think if you listen to the recording, it's clear that Dates is the one who's in control of what's happening here. So our position is that this entire encounter, both once they're at the door, through the time that he gets back to his house, remained consensual, that because he was not in custody, the officers were not required to read him his Miranda warnings. And looking at the totality of the circumstances, if you actually look at the second encounter that they have later on, where they do read him his Miranda rights, the officer asks him, do you believe that you're not under arrest right now? And Dates says, yes, I do. And that happens in a later encounter when arguably there's a lot more factors that could lead him to believe that he is in custody at that point. If you go back through the transcript of his testimony, and of course, the standard is not exactly what did Dates believe, it's a reasonable person, but there's nowhere in the transcript of his testimony where he even says he felt that he couldn't leave during the first encounter. He admits that he was the one in charge of the route of travel, that he told the officers to slow down when he felt that they were going too fast, that they were never physically aggressive toward him, they never took any of his personal belongings.
Well, in terms of the seizure, going back to the seizure, a person is seized if they have an objective reason to believe that they're not free to end the conversation. And that's why I was asking you earlier, why wouldn't he objectively have thought he's not free to end this conversation when he's already said, I need to speak to my attorney, and they've said, okay, we'll take you back, and then they start questioning again. Why isn't that objective reason for him to believe he's not free to end the conversation?
Well, Your Honor, I think that that's a good question. In terms of the legal analysis, there's no information that Dates gives during that limited period where they're driving back to his house that's incriminating in any way. So I would say hypothetically, even if there was a type of seizure that occurred then, which our position is that it did not, there's nothing to suppress. There's no statements there that he made that would have been introduced against him.
Counsel, can I just follow up and press you a little bit more on that point? So are you contending that really the only thing at issue is the time in which he is on his front porch, and he goes, it's gone for 6 minutes, and then he comes back, and he gets in the car, and then that's it? Is that your position in the sense that at that point he says the Walrus Hotmail address is mine or whatever. Is that your position, that we shouldn't care about anything that happens after that?
Well, Your Honor, I think that certainly you should care about what happens after that. In terms of what Dates has actually raised in his brief, I think that what he challenges is that entire interaction was not consensual. And our position is that it was, as is evidenced by the fact that when he said, oh, I don't want to talk to you, it's not, I don't want to talk to you ever, it's, I don't want to talk to you right now, and the officer simply follows up and says, okay, when would be a good time to talk? And then when he says, oh, you know, I have to go to work, I don't know if I can do this, but why don't we go somewhere else? Dates is the one who proposes all of that.
Right? And I understand that's your argument, and you've made that argument, but I'm trying to figure out what is actually relevant to our inquiry. And what I heard you previous answer to was whatever happened later with regard to the I want an attorney, that doesn't affect incriminating information. And is that not your position? I mean, nothing incriminating happened as a product of that. I thought that's what you were arguing, but maybe you're not.
No, I think that's correct, or Judge Moritz was asking, okay, well, on the way back, when they continue talking to him, basically, should we find that there's a seizure that occurred then? Our position is that there's not a seizure. However, it's not to say that that what happened isn't important. I'm simply pointing out that there was, even if they tried to ask him questions at that point, Dates clearly refuses to answer any of the questions. So there's no statements that he makes on the way back to his house that are incriminating against him in any way. He simply says, you know, I had told you that I wanted an attorney, and no, I'm not going to give you consent to search my computer. And I think if he was in a position where he really felt that, or a reasonable person in those circumstances, you know, he still could have asked to be let out of the car. And he, in fact, was pushing back against the agents, which I think goes to the fact that it was a consensual encounter. He's not just giving in to them when they keep questioning him. And to be fair, I don't think the agents got back into the car and then said, okay, well, let's go through this all again. I think that what the agent was trying to get at is, okay, you said you don't want to talk to us, but I want to see if maybe I can get him to consent to a search of the computer. That's the conversation that they have. So I don't know if that answers your question.
Thank you.
Okay. So I think the main important factor here is this court looks at the totality of the circumstances. And if you listen to the recording, I think it's clear that this is a consensual encounter. Dates is the one who agrees to ride with them in the car. He was given the specific option. He's giving directions as to the route of travel. He's also telling the officers to slow down when he feels like they're going too fast. And with regard to the custody issue, he's just simply not in custody at this time for Miranda purposes. And this court has made clear that if you're not in custody, officers are not required to read you your Miranda rights. I see that my time is up. May I just quickly finish my point?
Go ahead.
And so... We would ask this court to affirm the findings of the district court and the legal conclusions that this was a consensual encounter, that Dates was not in custody, and affirm the district court. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors. I would like to... My time hasn't... Okay. I would like to point out that even though Mr. Dates did have some control over the situation to the extent that he gave directions to the McDonald's, that he said, please slow down, that the inquiry has never been for this court that someone loses all sense of self, that they can no longer say anything in their own self-regard simply because they're in custody or they've been seized. The statements of Mr. Dates are pretty superficial in the context of everything that's going on. He's asking them to slow down in the school zone. He's giving them directions to McDonald's that the officers don't know how to get to. So in that case, those don't weigh against finding of a seizure or custody.
What weight, if any, should we put on his hearing testimony?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
What weight should we put on his hearing testimony?
Your Honor, I wasn't the attorney that conducted the hearing. I would have asked the question, Mr. Dates, did you feel free to leave? And that question wasn't posed to him. So I get that his hearing testimony is doesn't have a clear statement from Mr. Dates saying that he didn't feel free to leave. But I would point out again that it's an objective standard, and those objective facts are for us to, for Your Honors to review. But I would also point out that the question by Judge Moritz raises a larger issue, which is we know these are officers that are motivated and are not going to take no for an answer. They have a separate officer standing by waiting to incorporate any statements from Mr. Dates into a search warrant affidavit that they've all but drafted and are just waiting to have signed. This is a motivated investigatory operation. This is not a casual encounter. This is not something that happened by chance among an officer and a citizen. This was a set-up operation in order to extract the statements that they ultimately did. And it's in that context that we have to see all of the refusals by Mr. Dates and the trickery and the motivated questioning by the officers. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel. We appreciate the arguments. Counsel are excused, and the case shall be submitted.